Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
It's America's birthday, 246 years old. The question, should we be concerned about the future of democracy? We'll pose that question to our first guest, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, and later in the show, Hamilton Nolan of In These Times magazine on the future of organizing in America. Welcome to the Monday, July 4th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms, and that includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and the platform known as Stitcher. Yes, Randy Weingarten is going to be our first guest on the show, and she is president of the American Federation of Teachers, part of the AFL-CIO. We're talking 1.7 million members, a union that represents not only teachers, but paraprofessionals and school-related personnel, higher education faculty and staff, nurses and other healthcare professionals, local, state, and federal government employees, and early childhood educators. The AFT is dedicated to the belief that every person in America, everyone, deserves the freedom to thrive, fueled by opportunity, justice, and a voice in our democracy. This freedom is achieved through an economy that works for all, including the ability to form a union, great public schools, and affordable higher education, healthcare as a right, retirement security, the right to vote, civil rights, a vibrant democracy, and safe, welcoming, and healthy environments and communities. With that being said, don't you think Randy and her union is the perfect guest for the July 4th edition? On top of that, they are getting ready for their national convention, the AFT, which is in 10 days, July 14th through July 17th. And the theme of this year's convention is Reclaiming Our Future, Fighting for the Promise of a Better America. And you think back to 1776 and our forefathers. What did they want? They wanted an America. They wanted a unique country. And they got it. They had to fight for it. Let's be honest. And you know what? We're still fighting for that better America today. The delegates at that convention will elect the AFT president. And I don't think Randy has any opposition. They're also going to elect the secretary treasurer, executive vice president, and 43 vice presidents. One of them is Melissa Cropper, who is president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers. And Randy's going to talk about her briefly as well. But Randy is a fireball. She once worked on Wall Street. She's an attorney. She's got a legal background. And she also holds degrees from Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And I mentioned her working on Wall Street. There was a firm, Strook and Strook and Lavon. And she did that back from 1983 to 1986. She's also an active member in the Democratic National Committee. She is a fireball, and she's going to be our first guest. She's also going to talk about teachers being armed in schools because of the shootings going on. She will address that on the show. She's also going to talk about her visit to Poland near the Ukrainian border. This happened back in April. In fact, we tried to link up with Randy back then to talk about that, but unfortunately, there was a shooting at a charter school in New York, which she had a role in some years back. But Randy visited a school, and this was on behalf of the Polish Teachers Union, ZNP, as part of the global labor movement's commitment to assist the region's educators. And the AFT, get this, raised
over $100,000 from the union's relief fund to send supplies over there. So Randy Weingarten will be our first guest on the show. Hamilton Nolan will be joining us later on, and he comes to us from In These Times magazine. And I thought he would be interesting to bring to the show for one reason in particular. He is a bit critical of the AFL-CIO for not being aggressive enough. And let me explain. At the convention in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago, Liz Shuler announced that the Federation has put together a game plan to organize at least 1 million members, at least 1 million members in 10 years. Hamilton said, okay, I get it, but you know what? That goal sucks. That's what he said. He says that goal sucks. And instead, he's encouraging labor leaders to be thinking in terms of doubling union density, which, according to Hamilton, would bring us back to where we were in 1980, before Reagan took office and started the downward spin when he fired the air traffic controllers. Now, Liz Shuler said that's a floor, not a ceiling. I get that. But nonetheless, Hamilton says we have to do better. We have to do better if unions are going to survive. So Hamilton Nolan will be our second guest on America's Workforce. Well, there's another Hamilton I want to call attention to today. Alexander Hamilton, founding father of the United States, fought in the American Revolutionary War, even helped draft the Constitution, and served as the first Secretary of the Treasury. He was the founder and chief architect of the American financial system. But did you know that he was a big proponent of manufacturing? I mean, think about this. This is like late 1700s, early 1800s. He died in 1804. Now, this came to light in a recent conversation I had with Scott Paul. Scott, of course, is a frequent contributor to America's Workforce. And on a recent episode, he talked about Alexander Hamilton's role in manufacturing. Let's listen once again.
I'm a student of history, and one of the things I do, on my own is just I read history for pleasure. One of the things that's always fascinated me, the musical, Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical Hamilton, is based on this biography by Ron Chernow. And obviously, he set it to life and added a lot of context and all of that. But I think one of the underappreciated things about Hamilton was his role in shaping economic policy in the United States. And you can go in a number of different directions, from revenue collection to the Coast Guard to the post office to the first bank of the United States. But one thing that he did was to establish our nation's first manufacturing policy. And when he was the Treasury Secretary under George Washington, and he was pretty enthusiastic about that, because as a colonel in the Revolutionary War, he and Washington understood what it meant to be dependent on the French and not to have a domestic manufacturing capacity to make their own armaments, and what a problem that could be in the future. And they wanted to find a way to shift from a more agrarian economy, and obviously the plantation economy with enslaved people in the South, but to find a way for America to make more of the things that it consumed, and that it would make us a stronger nation. And he understood that. And not only that, I'll just add this last, he understood the way to do it too. You needed to invest in what were called internal improvements, build a canal, build roads that connected cities together, and also to have tariffs to protect industries that you were trying to start up in the United States of America, and to make also sure that people understood that it was virtuous to have a career it wasn't a factory back then. It was more like a foundry or something like that. But that was a good thing to do. So it was, he was ahead of his time. in a lot of ways.
Just another tidbit of information of our forefathers as we celebrate this July 4th holiday. Alexander Hamilton and manufacturing a long time ago in a different America, no doubt about that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to link up with the president of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. Make sure you get the word union in there, AWF Union Podcast. All right, let's go to Washington, and joining us on our live line this 4th of July holiday is the president of the American Federation of Teachers. That would be Randy Weingarten, who's been president, hard to believe, for 14 years. She was elected to that position back in 2008 when Obama was about to become president of the United States. Randy Weingarten, happy July 4th today. Thanks for joining us on this very special occasion.
Happy July 4th. It is one that is fraught with the biggest existential threat to our democracy that we've ever had.
And I noticed your convention is coming up in actually 10 days. This is going to take place in Boston, appropriate place. And its theme is Reclaiming Our Future, Fighting for the Promise of a Better America. And when I saw that, I thought to myself, 246 years ago, we had our forefathers fighting for an America. We didn't know what was going to transpire, but we had some people that believed in the United States of America, and here we are. So I have to ask you, how do you feel? Do you think we're going to make it to 254 years from now? I mean, with all these threats on our democracy, what's your answer to that, Randy?
Look, I hope so, and I think we have to do everything we can to make that so. And what America was an idea in the 1700s about people who wanted freedom, and they wanted to make sure that that Great Britain and England and the king didn't continue to abuse them. And it was, for certain people at that point, it was essentially white men of the landed, the gentry class. But if you look at America over the course of the next 200 plus years, you see what King said, that the arc of history does bend towards justice and that everyone should have a shot and a say in this country. And, the struggle against slavery, which was a huge stain on the country,
the struggle for emancipation, the backsliding, and then the continued fight for emancipation and the fight for equality and the fight for opportunity through a justice lens. And the same in terms of women, the fight for the vote. And now the same in terms of, you know, of people who are LGBTQ, the same in terms of people who are from our tribal nation, the same in terms of people who are disabled and need to have the access to the vote. What happens in America is that we tend to do one step forward, sometimes two steps backwards, two steps forward, one step backwards. But it is all about making sure that everyone has a voice and a vote, and not have the politicians decide their electorate, but have the voters decide who represents us. And we're, you know, in the midst of one of those moments, and MAGA, the MAGA forces, the Trump forces, were not the cause of it, but they have done so much to basically through a push for grievance and for to roll back a clock. How is it that Donald Trump could use birtherism to try to undermine Barack Obama, who was born in the United States? How is it that he could use a big lie to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power, something that we took for granted until January 6th, 2021? How is it that we could be this close to the demise of a voice in America? That's right now what we're fighting. How is it that a Supreme Court for the first time in 50 years could take away fundamental rights? That's what we're fighting in America, for freedom for all, for justice for all, for equality for all, for opportunity for all. That's the fight right now. But the way, in order to have this fight, in order to ensure that people have a voice, is to have a democracy. And we're perilously close to an autocracy.
Do you feel the clock has, like, been turned back to the 1950s or even before that? Is that how you feel right now, Randy?
I feel like we're in the midst of that fight. I feel that there's been a gut punch in the last week the last 2 weeks in terms of the Supreme Court. As Linda Greenhouse, one of the observers of the court for years, has said, they're just basically doing whatever they want. They have six votes, and so they're trying to remake America in one judicial session based upon their ideology. Remember, these six people who are Supreme Court justices, they were appointed by presidents who never actually garnered a majority of the vote in an election.
Right. Yeah, they didn't get the popular vote.
Or at least
the electoral
five of them.
Vote.
Yeah.
Right. Your convention that's coming up, Reclaiming Our Future, Fighting for the Promise of a Better America, I take it that what we're talking about right now is going to come up during the course of that convention, July 14th through the 17th.
Yeah.
And I know there's going to be delegates that will be elected, yourself included, Secretary, Treasurer, Executive Vice President, 43 Vice Presidents, a lot of folks there. But the timing of it all, and this is, again, a biennial convention, and we've been through, oh, my gosh, you've been all over the news, the pandemic. We're still in the pandemic. Schools shut down. There was a fight with politicians to open them up. The masks. I mean, we could go on and on and on.
On and on.
Yeah, this is going to be a good convention. Well, I got the feeling there's going to be a lot of angst here, right?
Well, but every period in life, you can view through a lens of hope or fear. And what you see happening with a lot of these politicians who have been engaged in the culture war is they don't want to solve problems. So they try to divert attention through making people, trying to make people angry. look, solve the problems. We have to solve the problem of the pandemic. We needed to both have in-person learning and it be safe. That's what we were trying to figure out. We didn't want schools closed. We wanted schools open in person. And, you know, then you had the math wars and then you had other things. But at the end of the day, what teachers want to do, what, you know, bus drivers want to do, what other frontline workers want to do, is they want to do their jobs. Teachers want to help kids have a safe and welcoming environment and help kids thrive. And so how do we do that? We have to do that by, you know, by making sure we have the resources, making sure we go back to basics, making sure we can help kids have joy in their, you know, in their school lives, having you know, focusing on reading, having pathways for kids to choose from, whether it be affordable, accessible college or career tech ed, having the kind of things that help kids thrive. So where are these politicians helping us do this? Why do they keep on starting culture wars? Why do they keep on trying to pit people against each other instead of actually helping us help kids thrive? And part of it is they don't want public schools. Look at Betsy DeVos. Look at her, you know, some of her pals that she, you know, that she pals around with. They want to privatize and they want to divert funding somewhere else. Look at what they did in terms of guns for you know, in Ohio, in your neck of the woods. Look at what they've just done. We have terrible mass shootings in Uvalde, Texas, where teachers shielded kids, where kids were, you know, where kids were lying, dying over 78 minutes. Sad, horrible shooting in Buffalo, where grandmas were lying, dying because of a maniac with a AR-15 and hate in his heart. So what's the first thing that the Ohio legislature does? Arm more people. As opposed to, why don't we just try to get guns out of the hands of bad guys? Why don't we get guns out of the hands of kids? Why do we have AR-15s in the hands of anybody who is a civilian? And so the insanity of saying that teachers should be armed with guns when the same politicians don't trust us to be armed with books and with curriculum. So, like, trust us to do what we're trained to do, which is to teach kids and to help them discern fact from fiction. Don't suggest that we should be armed with guns. When, you know, what we really, when what we should really be doing is making sure schools are safe sanctuaries.
You mentioned Ohio. They reduced the training from 700 hours to 24 hours for teachers who want to take a gun to school. And right. I've already seen a number of districts say, no, we're not going to do that. Do you see that as a trend in various states that want to arm teachers? I think in Texas, a lot of Texas, of course, guns are all over the place there. But I've seen a number of districts say, no, we're not going to do this. Is that pretty much the trend in your opinion?
It is pretty much the trend. This is a talking point by the gun manufacturers, and you know, and the security people are salivating. Because they see this as simply a vehicle to help them sell more guns and help them sell more hardware, as opposed to solving the problem. So anyone who has spent 3.5 nanoseconds in a school understands just how insane it is to arm a teacher with a gun. And that's why in Texas, for example, it doesn't, when they've had the right to do this since Parkland, maybe beforehand, there's less than 300 people in the entire, less than 300 educators in the entire state of Texas that have opted to do this. So all this is a diversion of attention. It's a soundbite that to try to answer the fact that we've had a mass shooting and we need to reduce the number of guns that are out in society, not increase the number of guns in a school.
Now, President Biden recently signed legislation that would restrict some of what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
I know it didn't go very far enough, but do you feel that that's a step in the right direction?
I do. I think that it was very important for Democrats and Republicans to come together and do something. And it's the first change in terms of gun safety in 30-some-odd years in the Congress. And so I think that is a step in the right direction. We have to solve problems on behalf of Americans. The sound bites, the blaming, that doesn't solve problems. We have to solve problems for people. And that's what people expect educators to do every single day, help kids learn. That's what people expect nurses to do and doctors to do, to help people. That's what people want. That's what people need. And what's happened is that there is an utter frustration now that they're yelling and shouting and pointing of fingers instead of solving problems. And frankly, I'm sick and tired of politicians who just want to shame and blame the people who are closest to our kids instead of helping us help our kids.
I hear you. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, on our live line this special day, July 4th holiday. She's a leader of 1.7 million members. We're talking not just teachers, but paraprofessionals, school-related personnel, higher education faculty, staff, nurses, healthcare, you name it, along with public employees. We'll continue the conversation right after this.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this upcoming segment is brought to you by the United Labor Agency. They connect people with employment. 216-666-2185. You can find them online at ulagency.org.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without ironworkers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained ironworkers and 20,000 apprentices, the Ironworkers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Ironworkers, the sky's the limit.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, we're on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so please keep them coming. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. AFT.org is your website. We do this segment with Melissa Cropper, who's a vice president, by the way, on the AFT board. And she represents
Absolutely. The
Ohio Federation. She says she loves you. You know that. And I know you like her, too.
And
she's
I
a
love
pistol.
Her back.
There she you is. Go. There you go.
Let me just say, this is what I mean by problem solvers. Melissa's a problem solver. Most of the people who are in our orbit, in terms of the American Federation of Teachers, we try to solve problems. We try to help teachers have the conditions they need to teach and students need to learn. We try to make sure, we try to fight for, economic conditions so families can prosper. That's what we're talking about when we say, let's have the conditions in America so you have a shot. And what we have instead is there's one political party that just has grievance, 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 as opposed to helping people help themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the party of no. You know, you come up with a good idea, no, we're not going to do that, or we don't have money for it, or this is not the time for it. And it's so sad because, to your point, Randy, people want things. Why do you elect somebody to represent you? To change the system, to make it better, to make your life better, to make your kids' life better. That's what it's all about. And we've gotten so far away from that. Randy, we tried to reach you a couple of months ago, and I know, again, I remember getting the call that morning. This was back in April. I wanted to talk about your visit to Poland to visit the refugees from Ukraine. And I remember that weekend, I guess, on a Friday afternoon, and it tied you up the whole weekend. You were, you started a charter school. You were involved in getting a charter school together in outside of New York or someplace in New York, and there was a shooting there. There was a shooting there. And it was ridiculous, but we've already addressed this as far as the shootings in America and guns and teachers and all that. But let's go back to that time because it really interests me that you went there, not what you call a safe territory. This was very close to the Ukrainian border, but you have a history I think a lot of people are not aware of when it comes to Ukraine. And going back to, my gosh, this would be what? World War II era? Can you speak to that, Randy?
So, you know, even farther than that. So, first, let me just say that our union has really been about fighting for democracy, both here and abroad, fighting to make sure that people have voice and agency and freedom, and that everybody has a shot, a say and a shot in life. You know, my grandfather actually was in medical school. He came from Ukraine. He has long since passed. And he brought his entire family from Ukraine to the United States at the turn of the, you know, in the early 1900s. And he was escaping persecution. He grew up in a place called Kamianets-Podilsky. And they were escaping the pogroms at the time, which, you know, many Jews did in Eastern Europe, just like many Italians did in, you know, southern Italy or in Italy at the time. And that was the immigration to the United States, you know, in the early 1900s. But we've had a long relationship, the AFT has, with, you know, Polish teachers, Ukrainian teachers. We spent a lot of time helping the Polish Solidarność Union and movement trying to gain democracy in, you know, in the period of time after World War II and the Iron Curtain. And that's part of what we do internationally. We want kids to be educated all throughout the world, and we want workers to have decent and families to have to thrive, and that starts with a voice in democracy. And so what's happening in Ukraine right now, and you see it, you know, you see it this week, Russia has, and Putin in particular, has decided that he wants to go back to the old Soviet, not even the Soviet Empire, the old Russian Empire of Peter the Great. And that is, and so he doesn't care that he is taking over a country that is independent, that has self-determination. And so he is doing it through terror and through brutality to a country that does not want it, that wants its democracy. And there have been, the tragedies are too many to enumerate, but there's 300,000 children, for example, who have been taken into Russia, Ukrainian children taken into Russia as prisoners of war. There are thousands of children who are, hundreds of thousands, who are refugees in Poland and other places. And so the Polish Teachers Union with the Ukrainian Teachers Union are really trying to help them. And I was in Poland as part of that, you know, to bear witness and to help. And in fact, this summer, we are sending American teachers to Poland to help Ukrainian kids in summer camp. And we are helping to support the Polish Teacher Union in helping Ukrainian kids in summer camp. and we're doing whatever support we can do.
See, that's amazing to me. And these are the stories that are often missed by the mainstream media. I don't know. Did you get any coverage when you went to Poland? Because and even the AFT, I remember at that time you raised like $100,000 from your Union Relief Fund. Did anybody pick up on that?
Yeah, we got a little bit of coverage, but you know what you see is, you know, you'll never see any coverage on Fox because there is an attempt by the, it's not even conservative forces in this country. Most of the country is, you know, leans, most of the country is moderate. It may lean a little right, it may lean a little left, but most of the country is moderate. What you see is an extremist force that does not want other people to have any power. They don't want regular folks to have power. They don't want regular folks to have labor unions. They don't want regular folks to basically have shared prosperity. So they create grievance and fear of the other and attempt to, you know, to maximize on hate and on anxiety. So no, you didn't see Fox cover my trip to Poland.
No, they don't like teacher unions. No, they don't.
No.
It's amazing.
They don't like public education. They don't.
Right.
They don't
right.
want institutions that thrive, because institutions that thrive help create broad based equality and opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And the powers that be. Some of the people that run Fox, Murdoch, et cetera, doesn't want to part with anything that he has.
No, no. And it's sad that they have such a large audience. Not as big as their traditional networks, though, but still a pretty large audience. All right, one more question here, and topic, I should say, and that is the convention, the Constitutional Convention that happened a couple of weeks ago in the city of Philadelphia, where we saw Liz Schuler become the first woman to head the AFL-CIO. And then you got Fred Redmond, great guy, the number two guy, the first African-American to have the position of Secretary-Treasurer. So, Randy, this had to be something for you because you, of course, are a female running a large union, 1.7 million members. I know this was not an easy trek to get to the top, and even more so for someone like Liz Schuler, but that had to be a moment for you, wasn't it?
It was great. And Liz, I was honored that Liz, I was honored that Liz asked me to second her nomination, which I was honored to do. She'll be a great president of the AFL. She has already been a great president. You know, she was elected president when Rich Trumka, you know, suddenly passed. And What she's doing, her great strengths are that she's not only a uniter who understands in her DNA the importance of the labor movement to the aspirations of working people everywhere, but she understands how to bring people together to mobilize and organize and solve problems. And I think you could see that in the convention. So I'm really I'm thrilled that she's the president of our federation.
Randy, I apologize. One more question here, because we hit on the politics and the craziness that's going on and the division in America. But aside of that, you as a union leader have to be so excited about the future of unions. I mean, you think about it. You got a pro-union president, got a great guy as labor secretary, got the right person in the Department of Education, no doubt there. But all the organizing going on, that's got to make you feel pretty darn good, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, there's a world of possibility here. Working people in America understand that they need and want unions. That unions are a vehicle to prosperity. It's a vehicle. They are a vehicle to fairness. Look at what the Starbucks workers are doing. Look at what Apple workers are doing. Look at what Amazon workers are doing. We just, in the last couple of weeks, the AUP, the American Association of University Professors, affiliated with the AFT. We know we're stronger together, but stronger together means that the more people unionize, the more people have a labor movement to back them up, the more they have the power to have a better life. That's what unions bring, the power of fairness in the workplace, the power to have a better life. And frankly, every worker in America should have that. That's what the labor laws passed in the 1930s were about, that said that if workers wanted to organize, they were entitled to a union. It wasn't neutral. It was a policy that basically said that there was an entitlement, the freedom to organize if a worker wanted it. And you've had 60 years of corporate America trying to undermine that right. Now you see workers everywhere, particularly those who are non-unionized, saying, we want this because the union difference creates a difference in terms of prosperity.
Boy, there's a lot of fight in you, Randy. I love having you on the show. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT.org. 10 days from now, they'll be in Boston, reclaiming our future, fighting for the promise of a better America. Randy, let's keep in touch more often. There's a lot at stake here in America. You know that. We want to keep it going, and you're the right person to be in the group here, okay?
Thank you so much, Ed.
So glad to have her as part of America's workforce. Once again, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT.org, for more information. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Hamilton Nolan, a writer at In These Times magazine, talking about organizing. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's L-I-U-N-A.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this upcoming segment is brought to you by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Check them out online at oft-aft.org.
Hello from the Communication Workers of America, District 4. We are a labor union representing a vast array of workers in different industries, including the Association of Flight Attendants, Telecommunications, CWA Passenger Services, Public Health Care, and Education Workers, the IUE, CWA Industrial Division, the National Association of Broadcast Employees, the CWA News Guild, not to mention our growing digital sector, and many others. If you're interested in organizing your work group or learning more about what it means to be CWA strong, visit our website at www.cwad4.org. That's CWAD4.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. Make sure you get the word union in there. All right, let's go to Brooklyn, New York right now. And joining us on line number two is Hamilton Nolan of In These Times magazine. We used to do a monthly feature with them some years back. And Hamilton has been with the publication for a number of years. And he came out with an opinion piece regarding organizing. Now, at the recent convention with the AFL-CIO, which we talked about briefly with Randy Weingarten, they announced an organizing drive. 1 million new workers in a decade. Okay, that may sound like a lot, but Hamilton has a different take on it. Hamilton Nolan, welcome to America's Workforce. How are we doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, man.
So talk to me about this, because you have to keep in mind that our economy is in a state of flux. People work one day, they quit the next day, they retire. And in fact, I had a story recently, the American Federation of Government Employees organized like 4,000 people in 1 month. They got 4,000 new members in 1 month. Unfortunately, they lost about 3,800 due to retirements and things like that. So they got a net gain. That was a good net gain, but the 4,000 was diminished rapidly. So what's your take on the million new workers in a decade?
Yeah, well, you know, a million can sound like a big number in a vacuum, but when you do the math on that kind of promise, a million new workers, new union members in the next decade would actually keep union density in America going down. And it would, if that was the number of new union members in the next decade, we're going to be looking at something like 9% total union density a decade from now. And as you know, and as your listeners know, you know, we're in a 50-year plus decline of union density in America, and that's been one of the leading contributors to a lot of the underlying social problems in America: inequality, economic inequality, social inequality, and everything that goes with that. And so turning around that union density decline has to be the top priority for the biggest labor organization in the nation, which is the AFL-CIO, that has around 13 million union members, give or take. And so while they came out and sort of waved the flag of organizing at the convention, the actual numbers that they are promising are sort of underwhelming, to say the least. And the problem is not that unions don't have the resources, because they do. The problem is really one of prioritizing new organizing and just getting the institutions of organized labor to understand the gravity of the problem that we're facing if union density continues to go down.
So a million workers in a decade, that's where – and they did clarify that later, saying, well, that's not the ceiling, that's the floor. We got to start there, and maybe they're saying that this would be attainable. But what do you think – should it be in order to catch up? I mean, we lost a lot of union members here in the last, like you pointed out, especially since Reagan fired the air traffic controllers. We always use that as a benchmark of when unions started their cascade downward. But what do you think it should be?
That's right. I mean, look, you know, if you go back to 1980 when all of the trouble started, I mean, not just for unions, but for inequality in America. I mean, inequality in America took off when Reagan came in. So 1980 is a fair benchmark to look back to. Union density was about double at that time. It was around 20%, and today it's just above 10%. So I mean, that to me is a fair goal. Now, obviously, it's a big job to organize another 15 million workers. So you know, a more reasonable goal might be 5 million new workers. At the very least, you want to get, I think the rock bottom floor goal has to be start raising union density. I mean, union density goes down almost every single year in America. I mean, there are years when it ticks up a little bit and everybody celebrates, and the next year it ticks down again. So the floor has to be, we're going to turn around the decline of union density in a sustained way and get that number going up again. So, I mean, if you're talking about anything less than 5 to 10 million workers, you're really thinking too small, because the stakes of this problem are not just how many union members there are going to be in America. It's, are we going to ever be able to build enough power for working people to turn around this long-term trend of inequality that's not only hurting people's wallets and hurting their standard of living, but also eroding people's faith in the American dream and institutions, and causing, I think, a lot of the crazy ripples in politics that we see today also.
Now, Hamilton, you know, it's not easy to organize, number one, and then trying to get a first contract, that's even more difficult. You can ask the Amazon workers in Staten Island what they're going through right now. So there's a lot of hurdles. We know that. It's been like that for a long time. I'm just wondering, I'm sure you're familiar with the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize, and And a lot of people, if given the opportunity, if there weren't so many hurdles, they would join a union like immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, we got to get some people on board, especially Democrats. Do you ever see that happening? And I go back to when Obama was president. I remember the, what was it, the EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act. They had an opportunity there. That kind of fell on deaf ears. So what do you think the future holds here?
Right. I mean, look, the PRO Act is a great bill. It would obviously help out organized labor a lot. It has no prospect of passing right now until the filibuster is gone. And there's no prospect of getting rid of the filibuster with the current Congress. And in all likelihood, the next Congress is going to be worse than the current Congress. And so realistically, there's a very, very low chance that the PRO Act is going to pass any time in the next couple of years. And who knows what's going to happen after that. And I think the bigger lesson that we all have to draw as the labor movement is we can't wait for politicians to save us. I mean, as you said, Obama, there's a long history of Democratic administrations not saving the labor movement. And all you have to do is pull out that chart of union density and you can see it keep going straight down through Republican and Democratic administrations. And so the good news is, you know, while organizing is hard, we know how to organize. There's tons of great, talented union organizers who know how to organize workers. And on top of that, as you also mentioned, the appetite in the public for unions is at a multi-decade high right now. So there are millions of workers that we know want unions, and there are lots of organizers who know how to organize. We just don't have enough organizers and enough capacity to reach all the people that want unions. And that's where it really comes down to a matter of dedicating the resources and spending the money to build the capacity to organize the people that want to be organized.
Now, Hamilton, you know some of the campaigns, successful, I might add, campaigns that are happening right now are doing so independently of labor unions. The Amazon campaign I just mentioned in Staten Island, they, I guess some unions reached out and they said, no, we're going to do this on our own. I'm wondering, is this the new trend here? What's your take on that?
I mean, I think it's kind of a symptom of what I just talked about, which is the demand for unions is higher than the capacity of unions to organize people. And when you see these independent campaigns taking off, not just at Amazon, but Trader Joe's, and it was a gas station, and REI, and various companies, you're seeing these take off. Workers don't want to sit around for years waiting for unions to have the time to get around to them. I mean, people want to organize now, and the workers need help now. I mean, why do people want to organize in the first place? They want to organize because they need help. They need that power to protect themselves. And so, you know, the labor movement has to kind of look within and say, look, people are demanding this of us. People are demanding to be organized, and we are not equipped to do it. They're making their own unions, which I applaud, by the way. It's great for the labor movement as a whole. But for the union establishment, it has to be a wake-up call to say we have to really get on our game and spend the money to be able to service all these workers.
I think it's important just to know that this is a very special day. It's July 4th, and this is the day we celebrate our independence. And I think if more people had the freedom, I mean, this is our freedom day. We celebrate our freedom. If they had the freedom to join a union, we know they will join a union. I mean, I've heard numbers like 60 million people. Boy, wouldn't that be nice?
That would really
shake up America, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I always feel like it's trying to sell people a raise. It's pretty easy to sell people on the idea of a union when they understand what it is. So all we got to do is help them get it.
There you go. Hamilton Nolan, In These Times magazine. Thanks for joining us today. Okay.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, that'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to check in with Tim Berg on behalf of the Ohio AFL-CIO and Sheet Metal Workers Local 4. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful holiday.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.